Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from Floridians for Lawsuit Reform. Florida accounts for 8% of U.S. property insurance claims, but 76% of the country's property insurance lawsuits, forcing higher premiums on Florida's families. Learn about solutions at fltortreform.com. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A plan closing a loophole in parental notification in Baker Act cases has mental health advocates in Florida cheering.
This change now requires them to have this in their actual internal policies, whereas before it was optional up to school.
Also this week, Robbie Gaffney speaks with lawyers over the legality of Florida's proposed transgender athlete ban and whether it discriminates against transgender students on the basis of sex.
It's an area that's evolving in the law, so it's not going to be, in my mind, easy. It would be clearly an uphill battle.
We'll also compare and contrast the so-called election reforms, which are now law in both Florida and Georgia, and get a preview of Florida lawmakers' return to Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. Parents have long fretted about schools' ability to circumvent parental decisions when it comes to children's critical health care matters. Now those loopholes are getting smaller after the Florida legislature approved provisions requiring parents to be notified before their child is sent for an involuntary psychiatric exam. More on that from Lynn Hatter.
Beth Carr's son was sent for an involuntary psychiatric exam in 2016 after what she describes as making a bad joke. Her then 15-year-old said he liked the smell of gasoline.
You know how kids are. They just say things. And the teacher said, well, do you know who else likes the smell of gasoline? Sociopaths.
Carr was featured in WFSU and Health News Florida's report on the Baker Act, a law that allows people to be involuntarily sent for psychiatric exams. Nearly 38,000 kids were Baker Acted in 2019, and a quarter of those referrals came from schools. Florida law says parents have to be notified before a Baker Act is initiated, but that does not always happen, just as the law says family members and friends should be allowed to intervene in some cases. But that's often overlooked as well.
In the case of children, it was happening way too much, specifically in school settings.
Diane Stein is with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which runs a Baker Act hotline. The organization helps people navigate the mental health system. It's affiliated with the Church of Scientology. CCHR is who Beth Carr called when her son was Baker Acted, and the organization was able to assist the family. For years, Florida lawmakers have tried to curb youth Baker Acts. This year, with the passage of parental notification measures, they may have finally moved the needle, says Stein.
But this change now requires them to have this in their actual internal policies, whereas before it was optional, it was up to the school.
The changes approved by the legislature eliminate that wiggle room. The bill requires parents be notified before their child is taken from campus, allowing them the opportunity to intervene. Stein says this year's bill is a big step forward on the Baker Act issue, especially when it comes to kids. CCHR is not the only organization cheering the measure's passage. Disability Rights Florida is too. Florida law says children with developmental disabilities should not be Baker Acted, but that's not always followed either. Disability Rights Florida's Caitlin Klibben is in agreement. The measure is a step in the right direction, and she's pleased to see stronger data reporting provisions in the bill, like standardizing how districts report Baker Acts.
Yes, it would apply to every district in this, you know, entire state. So yeah, it would provide hopefully uniformity and give us a good idea what's going on in every district, not just the ones that have more robust data on their own.
Still, there's a lot left on the table.
Well, I think that we could be better tracking, you know, the outcomes, whether these kids were actually admitted for treatment or whether they were just evaluated and then released, which would, you know, that would kind of imply that maybe the Baker Act wasn't necessary in the first place. I think we could do a better job of tracking, you know, kids with disabilities that are referred for Baker Act, so we can break out that information and see if there's a way to address, you know, maybe inappropriate or excessive Baker Acts of kids with disabilities. And then just breaking it down by demographic information.
Florida's Baker Act law was not written for children, but how to fix the problem has divided advocates for years. A proposed overhaul of the law by Plantation Democratic Senator Lauren Book did not get a hearing. I'm Len Hatter.
The GOP-backed ban on transgender students playing women and girls school sports is awaiting Governor Ron DeSantis' signature. Democrats and LGBTQ advocates say the move could result in lawsuits. More from Robbie Gaffney.
Governors in six states have already signed similar bans into law, and a seventh state has similar restrictions via executive order. Idaho's law is already facing a challenge. Proponents of the ban say people assigned male at birth have a physical advantage over those assigned female at birth. Meanwhile, Democrats and LGBTQ advocates like Equality Florida's Gina Duncan says the ban is harmful to young transgender people.
It is overtly discriminatory. And as called out by the Biden administration, this bill is illegal, discriminatory, and a violation of Title IX.
Adria Lynn Silva is a Title IX attorney. She says there's legal precedent prohibiting discrimination against transgender students. She points to a case in Virginia where a transgender boy was prohibited by a school board from using the boys' restroom.
The language that the court used is that when you discriminate against somebody because of their gender expression or their gender identity, it's the same kind of segregation that creates harmful stigma. And they made an analogy to the same kind of racial discrimination that students felt when students were forced to use separate bathrooms or restrooms, which was one of the issues in Brown versus the Board of Education.
The court ruled in favor of the transgender boy, Gavin Grimm. As for Florida's transgender athlete ban, Silva says the Republican argument relies on stereotypes.
You can't just make up a bunch of generally that, you know, girls and women athletes are going to be at a disadvantage if you allow somebody who identifies as transgender to compete on the women's team or the girls' team. That's the kind of sex stereotyping that Grimm prohibits.
The National Collegiate Athletic Association paves a way for transgender women and girls to compete on female teams. They have to undergo hormone therapy, which suppresses their testosterone. The Florida High School Athletic Association also allows for transgender athletes to compete. And since 2013, 11 transgender students have applied for and been allowed to play on the teams that align with their gender identity. But Florida's new law would do away with those policies in the state. Attorney Dean LaBeouf says challenging the ban will be difficult. He says the strongest case would be one where a transgender student meets the FHSAA or NCAA criteria to compete on female teams.
Then, of course, they would have to say that they applied and show that they applied and that they were not allowed to compete despite meeting that criteria. And I think that would give them standing to be able to bring the claim.
But he says establishing that the ban discriminates on the basis of sex is going to be difficult because the case law is still evolving around that area.
You know, that whole area is evolving, even in the employment sector. I think that it's changed a lot, but historically, that wasn't even a basis to bring a claim historically for employment discrimination, gender identification suits. So it's an area that's evolving in the law. So it's not going to be, in my mind, easy. It would be clearly an uphill battle.
LaBeouf says another hurdle a plaintiff would have to overcome is time.
Let's just say, hypothetically, they're a senior in high school and they want to compete on, let's just say, a tennis team. I'm assuming that there's a relatively short season for that. And so by the time they were denied their opportunity to do that and ended up getting an injunction from a court, it may be too late for them in terms of that season to be able to compete.
For now, LGBTQ advocates are urging DeSantis to veto the ban. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Still to come on Capitol Report, will compare and contrast election laws passed by the Georgia legislature with those just passed by Florida lawmakers and signed into law this week by Governor Ron DeSantis.
Well, so it is one of the provisions of Georgia's 98-page law that has been a little bit misunderstood and a little bit blown out of proportion.
After being mostly trounced in the 2020 election and essentially steamrolled during the legislative session just ended, Florida Democrats are shopping for a winning strategy.
Registering voters year-round, that is doing local programming, talking to Floridians about the issues that they care about.
And just when you thought it was safe to be in Tallahassee again, lawmakers are gearing up for a special session on a new gambling proposal. Legislative leaders say they plan to vet the already controversial plan carefully.
If we were, getting a 30-year mortgage on our house, we would read all the fine print and know exactly what we were getting into. This is no different. This is a 30-year deal for the state of Florida.
This week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed his state's hotly debated elections bill into law. Big chunks of that legislation are similar to what was signed into law earlier this year in Georgia. Blaise Ganey sat down with a journalistic colleague from the Peach State for a comparison.
The elections law signed into place by Governor Ron DeSantis Thursday received a lot of pushback from elections officials, Democrats, and voters. Leon County Election Supervisor Mark Early says the changes to drop boxes in the new law decreases the amount of access voters will have to use the method.
That's correct. Yep. The bill was kind of all over the place. First, we couldn't have any drop boxes, and they were only at early voting sites. And we're saying, what about our offices? So then we could have them at our offices, 24/7, as long as we had security cameras in place and that kind of thing to monitor it and kept the video for a record in case we needed to. But we're not allowed to use that. Many counties have the overnight drop boxes at their offices, and they've done that for years, decades, frankly, where voters could drop off vote by mail ballots, but also just elections paperwork and things like that.
So while elections officials were able to convince the legislature to allow drop boxes at elections offices, those will be the only ones that are open 24 hours. Any other drop box location will only be used during early voting hours and must be monitored by an employee of the elections supervisor's office. Another change would require elections officials to designate 30 days ahead of an election where drop boxes will be located, and after the election begins, they can't change it. When it comes to drop boxes in Georgia's new elections law, it's even more strict. The law made a change that only allows one drop box at each early voting site or per 100,000 active registered voters. In Fulton County last election, they had more than 30 drop boxes. With this new law, they'd only be allowed to have 8. And here to discuss other changes to Georgia's election law with me is Stephen Fowler of Georgia Public Radio.
I know one big thing that was talked about, at least in the media, was the handing out of water and food in lines. In Florida, that was something that already wasn't happening because you couldn't have solicitation within 150 feet of a polling location. Is that similar to what you saw there in Georgia?
Yeah, so Georgia law now says that you cannot give food or water to voters within 150 feet of the poll, which is that no campaigning zone, or within 25 feet of a voter in line. Now, it does have some provisions for poll workers and poll officials to put water out, like a water cooler or something out for voters to be able to use. And it doesn't necessarily prevent a third party group from setting up somewhere away from the polling place to have food or water for people. So it is one of the provisions of Georgia's 98-page law that has been a little bit misunderstood and a little bit blown out of proportion.
I'm not sure if Georgia has this change, but people cannot turn in ballots for more than 2 people that are not part of their immediate family. My supervisor of elections here thinks that it would cause a lot of problems in elderly neighborhoods where, one person may have a driver's license, the others may not. And one person is used to being able to collect all the ballots and turn them in for their neighbors. Now they would only be able to take 2 of those ballots. Is that something that you saw there with the change in Georgia?
Well, in 2019, Georgia lawmakers passed another big election bill that outlawed this process, which is known as ballot harvesting by some. And it changed the law to say that basically the voter has to personally mail the ballot themselves or have it delivered by their mother, father, grandparent, aunt, uncle, brother, sister, spouse, son, daughter, niece, nephew, grandchild, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, mother-in-law, father-in-law, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, or individual residing in the same household.
Oh, and another change here, which you just mentioned, you know, that immediate family there includes grandparents and grandchildren. Here in Florida, that was not the case until this elections bill, which now includes that, which, you know, for an elections bill that many saw as disenfranchising and unneeded, is a change that many applauded, actually. And one more part here I want to go over. You know, usually supervisors get help from private organizations who just want to contribute money to help get out more voter outreach or voter education. That no longer will be allowed. Has that issue came up there, you know, anything prohibiting supervisors from using private funds or volunteers?
Yeah, so Georgia actually has a couple different provisions that touch on parts of that. One measure in the bill that is seen as a good thing allows poll workers to serve in neighboring counties. Previously, you could only serve in the county that you lived in, but, you know, people don't live their lives in that one narrow area. And so, especially when there are poll worker shortages, this new provision will allow people to be able to serve adjacent counties. And if there are shortages, that means there's a bigger pool. But during the 2020 election cycle, there was a good deal of outside grant funding from Mark Zuckerberg's group, from the Schwarzenegger Institute and others that helped counties run elections during a pandemic. But now, moving forward, no election office can directly receive grant funding from third-party sources. It can go to the state and the state can give out money, or it can go to the big county government and they can assign it to the election office, but they can't just have direct funding. You know, here's $100,000 to the Leon County Elections Office to run their election. And like you mentioned, there are some questions about if that language applies to like a church donating time as a polling place or other things like that. And so before the next big elections in Georgia, that's going to have to be something figured out. So people trying to do good deeds and help elections run smoothly don't end up running afoul of the law.
That was Capitol reporter Blaise Gainey speaking with reporter Stephen Fowler from Georgia Public Radio. For years, Democrats have not fared as well as Republicans in Florida. The GOP has long held trifecta control in the state, with the party's members controlling both legislative chambers and the governor's office for a straight decade. One Democrat currently holds a statewide elected office. Valerie Crowder reports the party is working on a strategy to get more candidates elected and more of its priorities passed in the state legislature after an election cycle that dashed Democratic hopes for gains.
Republicans this legislative session prioritized national hot-button issues, including election security, social media censorship, and cracking down on rioting. Democrats in the minority weren't able to stop these more controversial bills from passing, and in the last week of session, Senate Minority Leader Gary Farmer resigned. The party's caucus members chose Broward County Senator Lauren Book to take over immediately. Book says she'll lead from behind.
It's not going to be the Lauren Book show. It's going to be the Jana Cruz show, the Randolph Bracey show, the Chev Jones show, the Jason Pizzo show, the Tina Polsky show, the Annette Tadeo show, because I want to elevate the voices of our caucus. Each member has their own story, their own truth, their own identity and peace.
Book says the legislative session wasn't all bad for Democrats. They were able to work a deal with Republicans to expand Medicaid coverage for new mothers from 2 months to 1 year after they give birth. Still, Democratic state lawmakers have been unsuccessful in their years-long effort to expand Medicaid to all Floridians who'd qualify under the Affordable Care Act. Book says they'll continue to push for that, but they'll take a more gradual approach.
Here's where we're starting, and I think we have to grow it from there, because clearly that's where they wanted to meet us, because we would like to expand all that we can, right? So let's start where they are and grow from there.
Another issue the party's focused on is messaging. A majority of voters have approved Democratic championed causes like legalizing medical marijuana use, restoring nonviolent felons' right to vote, and increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Still, the party has seen little success in statewide races. The only Democrat holding statewide elected office is Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, who many speculate might also run for governor. Democratic Party Executive Director Marcus Dixon says the party's leaders are finding ways to stay connected with voters on issues that matter to them.
We have to have that sustainable infrastructure. That's not just engaging folks just before the election, but that is engaging them year-round. That is registering voters year-round. That is doing local programming, talking to Floridians about the issues that they care about, understanding that better, building relationships with them.
Democrats are already in campaign mode heading into 2022. Several candidates are running for governor. Congressman Charlie Crist is so far the most well-known politician in the race. After Crist announced his candidacy in his hometown of St. Petersburg, he explained why he's running.
We need more dignity in our politics. We need more kindness. We need people who are public servants and strive to serve with a servant's heart. And then instead of working for corporations, working for our people. A great president once said that government's supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people. That's why I'm running, for the people of Florida, to give them their voice back, to make sure they're heard.
Crist is widely considered a centrist candidate. He was a Republican when he served as governor about a decade ago. Crist then became an independent before joining the Democratic Party after endorsing former President Barack Obama's re-election campaign in 2012. Democratic Party Executive Director Marcus Dixon wouldn't say if the party's shifting to the left or becoming more moderate. Instead, he says the party has room for a range of perspectives that benefit ordinary Floridians.
Our party's a Big Ten party, and I think we have a diversity of opinion along that spectrum. And we are the party of ideas, and we don't mind debating those ideas. And so, you know, we welcome all perspectives into the Democratic Party, and we'll continue to advocate for policies that benefit poor and working people in the state.
Democrats are also lining up to fill former Congressman Alcee Hastings' vacant seat. Hastings served his South Florida district for about 3 decades before he died last month at age 84. Democratic freshman state representative and former teacher Omari Hardy recently announced his candidacy, describing himself as an unapologetic progressive in a recent campaign video.
That's why I'm running, because we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to end establishment incremental politics and be the bold progressive voice that working-class people in this country need.
Florida Democratic Party Executive Director Marcus Dixon says he's glad to see so much enthusiasm among the party's candidates.
We are excited about our field and a number of races across the state, from that special election in CD20 to the governor's race. We feel like, you know, there are a lot of good Democrats who have done the work and represent the values of Floridians. They're going to have a chance to compete and make their case to the people, and Democrats in the primary and Floridians in the general will ultimately have a chance to decide.
Dixon says the party's leadership must work harder to communicate its values and priorities to ordinary voters, and he says that's exactly what they're working to do as campaigning gets underway in upcoming state and federal races. I'm Valerie Crowder.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a special lawmaking session to approve a new gambling agreement between the state of Florida and the Seminole Indian Tribe is scheduled to start a week from Monday. Regan McCarthy reports the move could open the door for more money for the state, but it also opens the door for potential lawsuits.
Florida has been endeavoring to work out the details of a new gambling agreement with the Seminole Indian Tribe for about a decade. And after leading those negotiations with the tribe for the past several years, Senate President Wilton Simpson said he hoped this could be the year a new deal would be signed.
I believe we're in a reasonable place that a compact could get finished sometime this year.
Then just before the end of the recent legislative session, Governor Ron DeSantis and the tribe came to an agreement on a 30-year compact deal that's expected to bring $2.5 billion into the state within the first 5 years. The deal includes giving the tribe control over statewide sports betting. Before the deal can be official, federal officials and state lawmakers need to give it the go-ahead. The legislature has scheduled a special session starting May 17th to parse the agreement. House Speaker Chris Sprouls says it warrants a careful look.
You know, it's a big deal. It's a 30-year deal for the state. So I think it's potentially a great opportunity, but I think it's one that we know that we should vet thoroughly. If we were, you know, getting a 30-year mortgage on our house, we would read all the fine print and know exactly what we were getting into. And this is no different. This is a 30-year deal for the state of Florida.
Sprouls says he looks forward to taking his time with the 70-page agreement. He says he also hopes to hear from constituents and stakeholders. He says legislation surrounding gambling can be complicated.
It's all interconnected. I know I've said that before. And, you know, it's kind of a hodgepodge of laws. So, you know, we're going to take our time. It's why it was important to us as a house, you know, to kind of let it hang out there for a while, be able to digest it, hear testimony, have people reach out, say what they liked or didn't like about the compact.
This is going to be the subject of intense, intense legal scrutiny.
Evan Ginney is co-minority leader in the House. He says House Democrats will look carefully at the new plan, but he says it faces an uphill climb. Many lawmakers have taken firm stances against any legislation they see as a gambling expansion. And he says outside groups are already pushing against the proposal.
While it is a, I think it's a very well-written compact, there are other large, financially very strong entities out there that aren't the tribe and aren't the state of Florida that really don't like this compact. So we're going to have to see how those forces come to bear.
Some of that stems from a constitutional amendment voters passed in 2018 that requires voter approval for any future gambling expansion. But the amendment has a carve-out for gambling that takes place at tribe casinos. Sprouls says the House will vet the issue carefully, but he doesn't see how the proposed compact agreement with the Seminoles would intersect with that amendment.
I don't believe that Amendment 3 doesn't necessarily apply to the tribe. Now, there may be other collateral issues in there that need to be looked at that interact, but as far as the actual tribe is concerned, you know, that as far as I understand, you know, Amendment 3 doesn't apply.
But others argue the amendment does apply because sports betting wouldn't take place solely on tribe property. Meanwhile, lawmakers are gearing up to examine a number of other gambling issues during the upcoming special session, including a move to allow paramutuals like Horse Tracks and High Life Rontons to keep offering card games and slot machines without requiring them to hold live events. And there's a push to create a new gambling commission. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Robbie Gaffney, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from Floridians for Lawsuit Reform. Florida accounts for 8% of U.S. property insurance claims, but 76% of the country's property insurance lawsuits, forcing higher premiums on Florida's families. Learn about solutions at fltortreform.com.